I'm Alex Michelson. Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. This week, the two big stories of the week are coronavirus, which continues to creep up, but yet the state continues to reopen. And of course, race, specifically questions about what should we do about policing in this country? And this week, we've got, I think, the two most important newsmakers on both of those topics. We've got Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert with us, plus Karen Bass, who is a congresswoman from Los Angeles, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, the one who actually wrote this police reform bill that the Democrats are now trying to pass and is negotiating on behalf of the Democrats to try to make it happen. Dr. Fauci is somebody we've been requesting for like 4 months. Amazingly, we got an email this week that's like, want to talk to Dr. Fauci? We're like, sure. So kind of came out of the blue. Karen Bass is somebody we've had on all the time. 2 weeks ago, she was on. And in this 2 weeks since, the world has completely changed. And she's been in the center of the entire thing. So I've never invited somebody back so quickly, but I thought it made sense to have her back. And she both conversations were really interesting and especially proud of this show. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Here is Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Dr. Fauci, welcome to The Issue Is.
Good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's talk about what a lot of people feel right now might be arbitrary in terms of the country's reopening. Because we see here in California, the numbers are going up, and yet we see so much of the state reopening, which leaves some people to wonder, why couldn't we have done this a few weeks ago? And is it really safe to be doing this now?
Yeah. Well, you know, California is a big state. And, you know, one of the things we have to be careful of when you talk about reopening, first of all, if you look at the country as a whole, it's so heterogeneous that you can't say what's happening in New York is necessarily the kind of guideline that you'd want to apply to a situation where you have a county which maybe has no infections. The clear goal right now is to try as safely as possible to reopen the country from the standpoint of going from the lockdown that we're in. We have guidelines that are clear guidelines, and there are guidelines that say you need to be in a certain situation where cases are going down, where you get to a benchmark that you go to one phase versus another versus another. As public health officials, we recommend very, very clearly that the states, the cities, and those who make the decisions at the local level abide by those guidelines as sort of a framework within which to act. The discretion of how that is done is always at the local level. The guidelines are there. So one of the things that we say that if you are going to open and you make a decision, that you do it with as much of the caution and adherence to the guidelines as possible. Some of the fundamental basic things, regardless of whether you strictly go by the guidelines or you leapfrog over, is there certain core things that shouldn't change. You can try and get the economy going and get people more socially connected and still wear masks, wash your hands, to the extent possible, stay physically distant from each other. If you can't, make sure you wear a mask and keep it on at all times. Yes, there are parts of the country where as you open, you're starting to see that there are cases that are blipping up. The critical issue is, do you have in place in your city or in your state the capability of manpower, testing, structure to identify, isolate, and contact trace so that resurgences that you see don't turn into big rebounds and flares? If you can do that, you might be able to progress in a measured way to trying to open. But you've got to do it with at least an attention to some of the fundamental guidelines.
Are you comfortable that that is in place here in California, where we do see the numbers going up?
You know, I don't, to be honest with you, I don't want to like waffle on the answer to the question, but I really would like to see myself, which I have not up to this interview, the exact numbers. Mm-hmm. Are the new cases merely because you're testing more, or is it testing more plus real new cases? And if it is real new cases, then you really got to be careful as you open up. But I don't want to prejudge what California is doing. I'm just giving you what the guidelines are and what the fundamental principles should be.
Let's talk for a moment about all those protests that we've seen, tens of thousands of people in the streets. When you saw that, what went through your mind? And if there isn't a big spike in cases in the next few weeks, what does that tell us about outdoor transmission?
Well, first of all, there are two things that come to my mind when I see the demonstrations. I mean, I clearly can understand the need and the constitutional right to peacefully demonstrate against the social injustices that are at hand now and the questions of violence against African Americans, particularly those instances that we saw with police violence. I mean, obviously, that's something that you really have to, in your own conscience, object to. One of the ways to do that is to demonstrate. However, in that context, with an appreciation and a feeling for why that's important, that is risky. There is no doubt that that is risky. And the fact is that when you put people together in a crowd, particularly if you don't wear a mask or if you pull the mask off when you're chanting or shouting, there is a real risk that there will be an upsurge of infections. Now, you're not going to see it for at least a few weeks after, because it isn't you have a demonstration on Sunday and then on Friday you're going to see infections. You're not. What's going to happen is that it will trickle in sort of subtly, and then you'll start to see an increase in cases and maybe an increase in hospitalizations. Now, you may get away with it, but the risk is considerable. It really is considerable. In my own city of Washington, D.C., we saw several of the D.C. National Guard who were involved in trying to contain the considerable demonstrations who were actually infected with the coronavirus. So that kind of close proximity, I would not be surprised if we see an uptick in cases due to that.
But if there's a slight uptick but not a big increase in deaths, does it tell us that outdoor transmission, not that big a deal?
No, I mean, I think you've really got to be careful about that. I wouldn't say it's a big deal. You may just be lucky at this particular point that it didn't happen. Outdoor transmission, as a fact, is less efficient than when people are enclosed in a room. There's no doubt about that. But still, we recommend when people are outside and cannot avoid being within that physical distance that we recommend, that they wear a mask.
Now, speaking of that, President Trump is going to start holding campaign rallies within the next week. That's a large-scale event. He's asking his supporters to sign liability waivers. Is that sort of event recommended right now? And did he check with you if something like that is a good idea?
Well, that's not the way things work. What we do with the task force is we set out guidelines. We make recommendations on public health issues based on data, based on science, and based on the patterns that we see in the community. We give recommendations. The president gets advice from any of a number of different factors in the White House. They can be public health, economic, physical, political, and others. So the only thing that we can do is that we would make a recommendation. But the ultimate decision is made based on input.
Would you recommend that that's a good idea to get a bunch of people together in an arena? Is that a safe thing right now?
No, I mean, I've said it over and over again. I'm not going to change my tune right now. When you congregate people together in a crowd and there is infection dynamics in a given community, that is a risk for spreading infection.
So what's the relationship like? Because we saw all of those briefings with the task force, and now we don't see it as much. Are you talking with the president every day?
No.
What's the status of the coronavirus task force?
Well, we had a meeting yesterday. It was a good meeting. We meet with the health components. Remember, the task force isn't just health people. There are a core group of doctors. There's myself. There's the director of the CDC, Barb Redfield. There's Ambassador Birx. There's Steve Hahn of the FDA, there's Seema Verma of CMS. So we meet even more frequently. It's true that the task force as such does not meet 7 days a week the way we used to when we were in the explosive component of it, when New York was in such trouble and things were going really bad. Right now, we still meet. We meet about 2 times a week. I met with the president just last Tuesday when I gave him a briefing on our vaccine work.
What do you make of the fact that he's essentially not following your guidelines when it comes to this event and when it comes to mask wearing and other things?
Well, again, I as I mentioned before, and I'll repeat it again, it isn't a question of pitting me or other health officials against the president. Is that the president takes input from right. any of a number of people. I give public health input and recommendations, but there's a lot of other input into the president besides that, and that's how he makes his decision.
Let's talk for a moment about vaccines. What is the status of that, and do you think we're going to see a vaccine by the end of the year?
You know, I think we will know if we have a safe and effective vaccine by the end of the year. There's never a guarantee that you will have a safe and effective vaccine, but I'm cautiously optimistic given what we've seen and given where we are right now. In the trials, we'll be starting a large efficacy trial in July, the first week or two in July, with one candidate. There'll be other candidates, several, that in sequence, sort of every month or so, one coming in August, one in September, one a little bit later. So we feel, based on the data that we've already seen, cautiously optimistic that we might have a vaccine, and that would be available either by the very end of this year or in the first couple of months of the 2021. Hopefully, we'll be able to scale up. We're already doing that to get doses that will be able to cover the people who need it. But again, there's no guarantee because vaccines are not easy to do.
That's very encouraging news to hear you say that. I want to take one moment, just as we wrap up, to talk about you. You have become a sort of national icon. There's Fauci on the couch pillows with your face on it. There's baby wear with your face on it. There's donuts with your face on it. How do you process sort of this celebrity that you've become? Harvey Levin of TMZ said you've become the biggest celebrity of the last few months.
Well, I process it by not taking myself too seriously. Once you start believing all of that, then you get into a world of unreality. I know where I am. I'm a public health official. I'm a scientist. I've devoted my entire professional life to the public health, and that's what I want to do. The situation with regard to the other things that you're talking about, I think what the country needs, as needed, is someone who can speak the truth, who can give good information, and give it in a way that's measured and calm and being realistic. And what they've done is that they've created this symbol that has all of those things that you were talking about. But, you know, I think that the ones who are doing that, in many respects, the shirts and all that, they're selling it for a good cause. That's good. I don't take myself too seriously in that regard.
And last question, one fun thing. I know you're a huge basketball fan. I'm a huge basketball fan. We're getting word that the NBA is coming back. Who's going to win the NBA Finals this year?
Well, you know, I have to say the Lakers for sure.
Yes, good answer. We right. like that. The question's going to be, can we have a parade?
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. We're sending this message to LeBron James, Dr. Fauci, officially picking the Lakers to win the NBA championship. We appreciate it. Thank you for all your service to our country. It is a great honor to talk with you, sir.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Our thanks to Dr. Anthony Fauci. Coming up next, a conversation about race with Karen Bass, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus.
A profession where you have the power to kill should be a profession that requires highly trained officers who are accountable to the public.
Congresswoman Karen Bass of Los Angeles is leading the Democrats' effort in Congress to pass a police reform bill. She's the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, and she joins us now via Skype from Washington, D.C. Congresswoman Bass, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You know, we had you on 2 weeks ago. I've never had a guest back on so quickly, but it is remarkable in 2 weeks how it seems like the entire world has changed, and you've been in the middle of the national debate that entire time. Can you process all that's happened in the last 2 weeks?
No. You know, it really has been very dramatic. And you know what is so sad? Because I think that the world stopped for a minute when they watched George Floyd be slowly tortured and killed. And I think that has been the catalyst for just tens of thousands of people out, not just around this country, in every state in the union, but also around the world. And so it presents an opportunity for us to make a significant transformative change in policing in the United States. And that's what's happened over the last couple of weeks.
Well, let's talk about what you want to do. We want to put up on the screen some of the main bullet points of the legislation that you are trying to pass. Let's put it up on the screen. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about police reform. Here are some of the main points. It would be require body and dashboard cameras, limit transfer of military weapons to state and local departments, ban chokeholds, no-knock warrants in drug cases, and it also lowers the bar for qualified immunity, which shields police from lawsuits. Those are some of the key parts of your policing act. What's the status of it? We hear that Kevin McCarthy, your friend on the Republican side, the leader, maybe says we should ban chokeholds.
Well, I just hung up with him about an hour ago, and so we're starting conversations. We'll be talking over the weekend, and so we are in an incredibly good place. We actually have a vote in committee next week, and then the week after that, we'll have a vote on a floor. And let me just tell you that when you introduce a massive bill like this, it usually takes a long time to get enough votes to pass, and I'm talking about Democratic votes. Well, we're already to the point where we have enough votes to pass off the floor even before it's out of committee. And I think that is completely because of the momentum in the streets. The country is ready for a change. I've been involved in this issue for years, and I have never seen polling that shows that 70% of the American peoples have said enough is enough. We have seen enough videos, and another one surfaced today. So the country's ripe for change, and we're going to make that change happen. I promised George Floyd's brother that we were going to make this happen.
So you got off the phone with the Republican leader. What did he tell you, and where is their agreement?
Well, we didn't get into the details, but basically what he said to me, and I know he said in the press, and we talked the other day as well. We've had a couple of conversations that he's very interested in doing something. He's looking over the bill. He wants our staff to get together and talk over the weekend. And so we agreed to check in. But I will tell you that after we did the hearing this week, I have a long list of Republican colleagues that I have to return their phone calls. I just haven't had a chance to return all the phone calls. Number of my Republican colleagues are calling saying, we want to do something, we need to do something. I've never seen this before. We're going to follow this momentum to the finish line.
One of the criticisms of the bill is that it doesn't do enough to address the issue of police unions. There's a lot of activists who feel like police unions are too strong in this country and they make it too hard to fire a bad cop. Do you think that police unions are too strong?
Well, I think that they can be, but I think if you talk to the police unions, I'm not sure that they would agree with the activists. But I do want you to know that I just left a message for the Fraternal Order of Police. I will be talking to him very soon. They did a letter, actually, and it wasn't a letter saying we're in love with the bill, but they also didn't say they hated it. That was a really big deal for the national organization to submit a letter. And that gave a lot of encouragement, I think, to both sides. I also met this week in Houston with the chief of police, Chief Acevedo, and he is the president of the National Police Chiefs Association. And he actually gave very positive testimony the other day. So you know what? I just think that the murder of George Floyd was just too much. It was just too much. And I think it's just very important that we make a difference this time. We have the opportunity to do that.
But
and
the critics would point to the fact that the officer who killed George Floyd had multiple disciplinary violations before it happened, and that perhaps the union stopped him from getting fired before, which is why maybe you need police union reform. What do you say to that?
Well, actually, I don't know about that. I do know that he had a number of complaints. But one of the things that the bill does, though, is it does a national registry so that if he left that job, remember when he got fired if he hadn't have been arrested, technically, he could have just gone to another district and gotten a job. If you remember the child, the 12-year-old child that would have graduated high school this year, Tamir Rice, he was killed within seconds when a police officer jumped out of the car and thought that the 12-year-old was a threat. Well, he had been fired from another jurisdiction. He lied on his application. And so one of the things that we will do in this bill is a national registry so that wouldn't be able to happen. The other thing that the bill does is that it will make it easier to fire, to prosecute, or to sue. And so it's really important that we make those structural changes. I don't know whether we could or should try to interfere with the union process. But one thing that I have heard is that some of the unions, especially with the newer officers, is that they're beginning to question some of the impact. And so one of the most important things that I hope this bill does is get at the police culture. You saw the picture of the 75-year-old man being shoved, and you saw that he fell and he hit his head in one of the protests. And a police officer leaned down to render assistance, and another police officer pulled him away. That was terrible. But the police culture that says, we know we can act with impunity because the law is on our side, and so if I kill somebody, how is it going to matter? I mean, that officer that killed George Floyd had his hand in his pocket. He was looking straight at the camera while he choked him to death.
Right.
He didn't care because he felt nothing was going to happen to him.
Activists say it's time to defund the police. Do you think it's time to defund the police?
No, I don't think it's time to defund the police. But let me tell you what I do think. And I agree with this. And you know I've worked on this for years. I think our budgets are out of balance in the city, in the state, and in the nation. And that one of the things that police complain about all the time, and I'm sure you've heard this from them, they tell you they're not social workers. Why should they be dealing with social, economic, and health problems? But what has happened over the years is that we have not invested properly in the proper balance. When we don't invest in society and address the problem, then the police officers are left to pick up the pieces. And I think that's wrong. That's why I don't believe this bill is an anti-police bill. I actually think we're trying to help the police officers. And so one of the parts of the bill is it provides grants to community-based organizations so they could re-envision how public safety should be managed in a community. You know, in the years that I worked in Community Coalition, as a matter of fact, one of the reasons why the coalition was formed 30 years ago was because I was concerned that a substance abuse problem called crack cocaine and an economic problem called deindustrialization was being criminalized. We passed laws to lock people up instead of dealing with problems like drug treatment and job training and job placement.
Well, let's talk about some of your history for a moment. Think back to the riots and you standing out in the streets of Los Angeles. And now all these years later, you are the one writing the legislation in the halls of Congress. How do you process that?
Well, I feel very, very honored, number one, that the speaker would give me this responsibility. I chair the committee where the legislation is going to come through, but I feel privileged, I feel honored, and I feel about 300 pounds heavier. it's a tremendous weight on my shoulders, but it's one that I am proud to carry. I do believe we're going to get this across the finish line, and I'm just so happy and thankful for all the protests. Now, I'm happy that the protests are peaceful now. I'm happy that there's not a destruction of property or any violence that's taking place, and I hope the protests continue until we deliver. We have to deliver from the American people. They're demanding it of us, and I'm ready to serve.
So you spoke with George Floyd's family this week. You went to the memorial in Houston. What did you say to them?
Well, you know, I mean, I just grieved with them. I mean, I know what it feels like. I know what it feels like to lose somebody suddenly. And it just broke my heart. It broke my heart to see how big the family was and just how they were just devastated. But you know what? I also looked up at this incredible portrait of George Floyd. And the year he was born, 1973, that was the year that I got involved in this work. In Los Angeles, it was an organization called the Coalition of Police Abuse. We had a really bad police chief at the time in L.A., and I looked up and I said, you know, that was 47 years ago. 47 years later, and here I am in the position to actually help make a difference. What I was trying to do 47 years ago was trying to make a difference. It's the same thing I'm doing today.
And one of your positions now, you are the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. And a lot of members of the African American community have expressed discomfort with the fact that President Trump will be holding a rally next week in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which was the site of one of the worst massacres of African Americans in this country. He's doing it on June 19th, which is the anniversary of the abolition of slavery. Do you think there's a chance that this is just a coincidence? Do you think he's trolling you? What do you think's going on here?
No, I've raised that with people in the administration. It was like, are you really trying to fan the flame? I mean, doing what he's doing is like desecrating the statue of Martin Luther King. I consider it an aggressive move. I consider it despicable. But you know, what can we say? He has been doing this since the moment he came down the escalator. He has started with every group. He started with Mexicans. He's always attacked African Americans. He's on to Asians by blaming China for the coronavirus. And you know, since he started doing that, you know that there have been hate crimes against Asian Pacific Islanders, Native Americans from Pocahontas. So he has always, whenever his poll numbers are down, whenever he feels that there's a problem, he goes after race. He stokes the fire, he fans the flames. And considering how delicate everything is in our country right now, why he would do something like this, it's beyond tone deaf. I think it's an aggressive move. I think he is attempting to incite problems.
We're going to have more with Congresswoman Bass up next, including a discussion of her future, a lot of talk about that, and the massive cultural changes that are underway. Reminder to check out our website, theissueisshow.com, and send us an email, theissueisshow@foxtv.com. Stay with us.
I'm joined now by Congresswoman Karen Bass,
the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass.
Congresswoman Karen Bass has literally been everywhere in the last couple of weeks in her role as chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Proud to say, of course, she was here on The Issue Is first. Congresswoman Karen Bass joins us now. It feels like we're proud. Our girl's going off and being a big star in the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's been kind of a remarkable moment for you. We've seen profiles of you in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, all within the last week and a half. And one of the things that we're starting to see in print is a discussion of you as one of the most likely people to be the next Speaker of the House. Is that a job you would want? And what do you make of that attention?
Well, I don't know. I certainly watch Madam Speaker, and she is an amazing leader, and I'm honored to serve as a member of her caucus. And I don't believe she's going anywhere. I don't want her to go anywhere, so I'm doing just fine.
Of course, Karen Bass was the Speaker of the California Assembly, the first African-American woman to hold that role. But there is one job that's open right now. And that, of course, is Vice President nominee for Joe Biden. There's so much discussion about potentially having an African-American woman in that role. Why not you?
Well, that's a little overwhelming. Obviously it would be an incredible honor. But I do think that the vice president, or at least the list that everyone is talking about, is an amazing list of women, most of whom I know. Very proud of our senator. And so we'll see. We'll see what the vice president does. I have been honored that he appointed me to co-chair a task force with a representative from the Sanders campaign. And we're wrapping up our work now, helping to develop the platform around the economy. And so it's one of an additional job I have, and I'm very proud to serve. I just can't wait until January of 2021, and I'm counting the days until the November election, and hoping that we make it there.
We've heard from other candidates for that VP slot that say that they are being vetted. Are you being vetted for that job?
No, I'm not being vetted, unless it's in secret and I don't know about it. No, I'm not being vetted. And
if you were offered it, would you accept it?
If I was offered it, of course I would. Yeah. Of course I would, sure. I would be honored to serve with the president. That just seems pretty amazing now.
Let's talk for a moment, all that attention on you. There's also been tremendous cultural changes just in the last couple weeks. Like, for instance, sort of a lighter note, but still a significant thing. We got a black bachelor coming to ABC. I don't know if you heard that. They just announced that for the first time in the 150 seasons of Years of the Bachelor that there's going to be an African-American leading that. We've also seen, you know, things like Cops is being taken off the air, Live PD being taken off the air, a reevaluation of how corporations do things. Do you think that some of this is an overreaction? Do you think this is appropriate? What do you make of this cultural moment?
I definitely don't think it's an overreaction, and I think all of it is positive, and it needs to continue, but it also needs to not be symbolic and not be superficial. So, for example, I've certainly seen a number of corporations talk about increasing their philanthropic giving and all, but, you know, I would also like to see their board of directors. I'd also like to see their executive staff, not just their line staff. So I think if we're going to make a cultural change, let's make it significant. To me, what is so important, though, you know, I mean, if you think about it, African Americans have been marching and protesting about police brutality for really over 100 years. And what I felt up until Rodney King was that we were just never believed. And then after the cell phone camera, it seemed to continue that, yeah, okay, people saw the cell phone, but then they wanted to know, well, what happened before? And let's find out about this suspect's background. None of which should have involved somebody losing their life, even if they had committed a crime. How about arresting and putting somebody on trial? How about innocent until proven guilty? And so I see the sea change, and my job is to take that sea change and make it legislative and bring about transformative change.
So lastly, you've been in this fight, as you said, for 47 years. Do you think that it's different this time? Is it actually different this time?
Yes, it absolutely feels different this time. I think what has happened before is that we've seen marches come and go. The character of these marches is completely different. In many respects, you look in the cameras and you see very few African Americans. Some of the marchers are predominantly white. And so for me as an African American to see thousands of young white folks carrying signs saying Black Lives Matter, maybe, just maybe, we're at a crossroads in our country where we can have a reasonable conversation on race. That makes me feel like this is different. That makes me feel like this is new. That makes me feel like this is going to get us where we need to go.
Congresswoman Karen Bass, make me one pledge. If you become the vice president, don't forget about us.
I will never do that.
You heard it here first. All right,
I'll
Congresswoman,
remember.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Nice to talk with you. It seems like every time an unarmed black man is killed by police, commentators say we need to have an uncomfortable conversation about race and policing. And this time, many of us are actually trying to have that conversation, and it turns out it's uncomfortable. To be totally honest, it's especially uncomfortable if, like me, you're white and you're not directly connected to law enforcement. You don't really know what to say or if your words are going to be misconstrued. But I've learned the best thing you can do is not really speak at all, but actually listen for a change. I've been moved by conversations with my black friends and colleagues. I never quite understood how deep their pain is after centuries of discrimination. I've heard from moms who are afraid for their safety of their black kids when they walk out the door. They're angry that police unions have far too often kept bad cops employed. But I've also spoken with police officers, and the overwhelming majority of them see those four Minnesota cops that killed George Floyd as murderers. Cops frequently have to make split-second decisions where there isn't always a good answer. If we villainize all cops, including the good ones, why would anyone want to join the force and reform it for the better? If we're going to see real change in this country, we need to stop screaming in each other's faces and try to actually hear each other out. That's not so easy to do in an era of social media narcissism and millisecond-long attention spans. But that's the only way a change is going to come.
Thanks to all of you for listening this week. Really appreciate it. Let me know what you think. Contact me on social media at Alex Michelson. We'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is.